reasonable amount.
Dr. Eric Crampton, the chief economist with the New Zealand Initiative, a think tank formed out of the merger of Business New Zealand and the New Zealand Institute, says it's really hard to get good answers on a firm's productivity and the wages it pays. He cites research by US economist Claudia Golden looking at very high paid professions, lawyers and accountants, for example, which shows that the people who get the big money are the ones who can be available 80 hours a week. He says for those businesses, often people want to deal with the same person all the time, so the people who can accommodate that are the ones who are in demand.
Somebody who's willing to put in 50 or 60 or 70 hours a week earns way more in terms of an hourly wage rate than someone who's putting in 30 or 40 hours a week. So that was what she came to as an explanation for the gender wage gap in American data, that more men than women, for whatever reason, are willing to put in what I consider to be stupidly long hours.
Or are able to put in. That, yeah.
Sure, yeah. Sure. More men than women will put in the stupidly long hours, and that drives some of the wage gap. Now, there'll be other parts of it that are well explained by other factors. So what Golden was looking at is what's left unexplained after we correct for a lot of other differences that we already know exist. Women take disproportionately more time out of the workforce during childbearing, even if you put in fairly gender-neutral policies, and that ends up turning into differences in experience. And employers then weight experience, and a wage gap starts opening up.
He points to other research also using US data, looking at whether employers are reluctant to hire women they think might go on maternity leave and its associated costs. They found the data appeared to confirm that employers were hiring in order to avoid paying maternity leave.
It's terrible that employers would be doing this, but if we're trying to think about appropriate policy for dealing with the gender wage gap, then we start thinking about what could we be doing to make it easier for employers to accommodate parental leave so that they're not trying to avoid having to do it. When we moved to New Zealand, we were very worried about that because we were both professionals. I came into a tenured appointment at the University of Canterbury. My wife was on the job market, and it takes a little while for new migrants to break into the job market here, and we thought that one of the reasons might be, in her case, that employers saw the spouse of someone who was a full-time academic and thought, well, she's going to be going into maternity very quickly. I don't want to have to deal with this. So she started just saying in interviews, I promise I won't have a kid for 5 years.
Research from Statistics New Zealand in 2016 found there's a so-called motherhood penalty. An analysis of household labour force survey earnings data found an overall gender pay gap of about 11%, even after adjusting for occupation, industry and age. Researchers then found the gender pay gap was greater for parents than for non-parents, and women with children are paid disproportionately less than men with children. They put the motherhood penalty at around 12%. Historian Barbara Brooks says as more and more women entered the workplace, no thought was given to how the working week plays out for two working parents.
Part of the campaign for equality and equal opportunity was to get women into occupations, but it didn't question the structure of those occupations, and it was still based on a male model. Someone who had no responsibilities at home, who, you know, could leave in the morning and come back at night, read the paper and eat dinner. But now everyone's worn ragged by both working long hours and trying to fit everything else around that. And still, women do the majority of housework.
In fact, for many women, girls can do anything has become girls have to do everything. The 2009 time use survey showed that men and women spent similar amounts of time on productive activities, about nearly 7 hours. Productive activities include work, household chores, child and family care, purchasing goods and services, and community services. But while men were paid for most of their time, about 63%, women were unpaid for most of their time, about 65%. The split has changed very little since 1998.
She was talking to us, not above us.
That was a very good speech. What can we do to make you Secretary General?
There have been 8 men over these last 70 years, and there's never been a woman.
The UN has got a serious gender problem.
That's something that's very much on the mind of two of the most well-known women of New Zealand's film industry, both of whom have films out this month. Miranda Harcourt and Gaylene Preston have both made films telling women's stories, one about Helen Clark and one based on a Margaret Mahe novel.
In 1985, when we released Mr. Wrong, I was one of the 8% of female Helmers, I think Variety calls it, of the world who had films in cinemas that year.
Wow.
I'm told this year, Miranda, you and I are part of 7%. If you spend your life cleaning up after people, if you spend your life wandering around with a clipboard, if you spend your life making lists for other people to do, and the camera's the best fun, and there's a great scrum around it, it's not personal. It's just the guys are really enthusiastic around the camera and nobody would have thought to make room for you.
Yeah.
And anyway, and also, you're not in their gang.
And you are disabled by your abilities in other areas, which are often abilities that that tend to be around organisation. I'm not saying you, I'm saying women.
Yeah.
That tend to be around things like household management. And luckily for you, and also luckily for me, I'm terrible at that.
For more than 20 years, more New Zealand women have graduated from law school than men. In fact, in 2013, nearly 62% of new admissions were women, up from a touch over 26% in 1980. But women are still wildly underrepresented in the upper echelons of the legal world, in both the public and private sectors. Less than 25% of partners at the country's 10 largest law firms are women. Of the 125 Queen's Counsel in 2015, just 21 were female. 70% of our judges are male. And while female lawyers outnumber men in nearly every area of the public sector, the one area that bucks that trend is at the very top among chief legal advisers. The Dean of Otago University's Law School is Mark Hennehan. He says a variety of factors contribute to this, including persisting expectations that women will raise children, a fraternal streak running through the profession, and the long hours demanded of lawyers in their 20s and 30s, which are wholly incompatible with raising a family.
It is staggering when you see the figures coming through, and I think many of us thought it would have changed more by now, but it seems to be the slowest area to change. I know, to be fair to the large firms, they are doing a lot more about diversity programs and trying to do more, but it's actually not happening on the ground. The figures just don't show that. I mean, I've been into law firms and say, why are people hanging around? In fact, I was talking to some young people the other day who are working in a firm, and I was saying, why don't you get in early and get your work done and you can get home at a reasonable time. Oh, no, it's not good to come in early because it's better to be here a bit later because it looks like you're really putting the hours in. I thought, this is just ridiculous.
Some firms are trying to do the work to attract a more diverse workforce. Joan Withers is an independent director and the chair of the warehouse group and energy firm Mercury. She says it's not just about equity and fairness, but pragmatic. No one is encouraging women to take on more leadership or encouraging more flexible work out of a sense of philanthropy.
The evidence is irrefutable in that if you have a more diverse group of people making decisions, the business is going to thrive. If you're not availing yourself of the total talent pool, then your performance is potentially going to be suboptimal. There are initiatives in train where, like the Champions for Change, where they are trying to seed that message in. For those dinosaur companies who, for whatever reason, don't buy into what seems to be just blinding obvious.
Joan Withers says the care workers settlement has started to address some of the issues, but there are three areas for women to keep an eye on.
Not just at the top level and saying, well, you know, what is it across the organisation? Is there any disparity in terms of what men or women are paid? But actually going in and doing much more granular analysis. So I chair the warehouse, for example, and we're doing work at the moment. So we look at it across a whole range of things. So the median hourly rate for employees by brand, we look at salaried employees, we look at store management, specifically support office, and then we look at the ratio of gender by pay band. And that really gives us some very clear insights into where there are problem areas and where there is inequity, and then you can start to address it.
The General Manager of Human Resources for ANZ Bank, Felicity Evans, is sick of having to explain why the bank has implemented the measures it has. Each interviewing panel at ANZ must include men and women, and both genders must also feature on the shortlist for every job. The bank allows every job to be flexible, offers 18 weeks paid parental leave and 2 weeks family leave to both mothers and fathers, and also pays the employer contribution on superannuation during parental leave. The company's management is 41.5% women, up significantly from just a few years ago.
We're monitoring everything. We monitor the number of women that have progressed through into management roles, recruitment, internal promotions, resignations, redundancies. So the whole flow, and we're tracking, are we biased one way or another? Have we slipped one way further than the other? And then we segment that down into particular areas, into geographies, into line manager, to particular line managers, particular projects, particular business units. So we can actually be really quite prescriptive, and we can be very detailed, and where are these areas, or where are these gaps, or where are some problems, or some opportunities that we may have as well.
Research from the Ministry for Women earlier this year found that 80% of the gender pay gap was unexplained. It defines the unexplained portion of the gap as unconscious and conscious bias and differences in behaviours and choices between men and women. The Equal Opportunities Commissioner, Jackie Blue, says overcoming those biases is difficult.
It comes back to like chooses like. When you've got an all-male interview panel and they are interviewing a female candidate or have a number of different options, one might be a woman or none might be a woman, they will choose people they feel comfortable with, and that's usually other white men as a generalisation. So it's just powerful biases at play, massive. And people who say, oh, quotas won't work because you just bring through inferior women, really fail to acknowledge the fact there are really serious biases going on.
But feminist economist Prue Hyman cautions against simply calling it sexism.
The different jobs that women actually do, particularly at detailed level, that's a big part of the explanation. It's not as much pure sexism, whatever pure sexism is, I think, as those studies show, because they don't look at occupation. And if you just say it's sexism, well, it's horrible, but, you know, then you can say, oh, well, government can't legislate away sexism, so it'll just educate and so on. So I think it's important to analyse it in a bit more detail and say, OK, the valuation of occupations, particularly female-dominated ones, is a large part of it, then, and an awful lot of that is public sector funded, then that does bring it back to being a very important government responsibility.
One measure introduced to Parliament in the last term but voted down is to force companies to release their gender statistics. Jackie Blue is a fan of that approach, but ANZ's Felicity Evans isn't so sure.
I'd start with the women in management, because I actually think that's the key. So I think you start publicly reporting those, and that shows for other candidates and that shows for other organisations. Is that somewhere I want to be aligned to? Do they support the values around gender equality that I want to be part of? So therefore you attract more people to you as well, the right sort of people.
And economist Eric Crampton warns, whatever the measure, against unintended consequences.
If you move to a system where a bureaucrat in Wellington is having to guess, well, is this role really comparable to that other role? And I've never worked in either role, and I've never tried to hire anybody into either of these roles, and I don't really know how many workers there are out there who are able to do either of these kinds of jobs. But I'm going to pronounce that this role is equivalent to that role and that they should be paid the same.
That's how we get back to where we were in the 1970s. That's how we get back to national awards.
National awards, basically central labor market planning. And we're seeing that already in the consequences of the wage settlement, right? Because they did it for one class of care workers and not for another. And entirely predictably, you're going to get a flow of workers from the less paid one to the more highly paid one.
But for unionist Maxine Gay, as well as raising women's pay, the care workers' case has given others hope that equal work will be recognised with equal pay. But she says the disparities exist.
What happens with a retail assistant, for example? So a retail assistant in a supermarket, you know, irrespective of the chain that they work for, essentially takes goods from the dock area that arrive. They take the, the pallets into the supermarket. They take the boxes off the pallets, and they either put the box or the goods that are inside the box on the shelf. Now, you go over to the distribution centre where those boxes came from in the first place. A worker in a distribution centre, you know, goes to a shelf, takes down a box, puts it on a pallet, takes it to the dock, that then goes on a truck and goes to the supermarket. There's between $5 and $7 an hour difference in the pay. The distribution centre is male-dominated, the supermarket is female-dominated.
And as much as the money, for care worker Tamara Badley, it's the recognition that their work, women's work, is worthwhile that's important.
Because for many years it was, well, if you don't like it, why don't you get a real job? You don't have a real job. You're not doing a real job.
The gender pay gap is complicated. It's not just discrimination, that would be easier to identify. It's a mixture of factors, but it won't go away if people pretend it's not there. Core Megan Welliner-Ho, and that's Insight for this week. You can share and podcast this and other insights from rnz.co.nz/insight or head to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That program was produced by me, Philippa Tolley, with technical production by Phil Bench. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at insight@radionz.co.nz or our Twitter handle is @insightrnz. It's been great to have you with us, and thanks for listening.